First of all, thanks for joining us a little early on the third day to the show. You know who the really dedicated attendees are that show up at an 8:30 session on the third day. We had a little customer appreciation event last night, so me and John are a bit hungover, so apologies. We appear a little bleary-eyed. It was a nice party. So, anyway, good morning. Good morning. There we go. Fantastic. My name is Alex Josh. I work for NetApp. I'm an architect in the Microsoft group. Today we're going to be talking about the Windows Server and some of our support for Windows Server that's planned. Actually, it's a pretty wide-ranging conversation today. The goal is to kind of talk about some of the transitional elements that are going into our data centers as we move forward. We are all planning pivots. We know that there's kind of this ongoing evaluation in your data centers. The Windows Server 2012 is one of those moments when we all have an opportunity to kind of reconsider what we're doing and why we're doing it. So there's a lot of discussion going on, a lot of good planning, a lot of good thinking about this. From a NetApp perspective, we're going to talk about the storage aspects of Server 2012 and kind of how we see this thing playing out, some of the things we're excited about, what we're working on. With me today is John Parker. John?
Yep. Hi.
John's going to be talking about SQL Server and some of the data availability groups in there.
Right. We'll talk SQL Server 2012, changes that it brings, and the really cool things we can do with 2012 and the data center of the future. So.
Awesome. All right, let's get into it. So when we look at Windows Server 2012, Hyper-V is obviously a big part of that, right? Server 2012 is really designed around Hyper-V. The assumption is that the vast majority of our workloads going into Server 2012 implementations are probably going to be running inside of our Hyper-V context. And when we look at it from a storage perspective, what we're really excited about are things like SMB 3.0 support, ODX, VSS for SMB, and continuous availability shares. And we're actually going to talk about each of these in turn. But to summarize, we really feel like this is a major pivot point in the way we design data centers going forward. We don't really think that in the Server 2012 world, we're just going to rinse and repeat the designs we're using in 2008 R2. There's a lot of things going on in Server 2012 that make that pivot possible. The storage platforms that you're sitting on top of from us and from our competitors have changed quite a bit in the last 5 years since the last time you did a major refresh. So all of these things together pretty much imply that you're going to be doing a major redesign as you go forward into this wave. This is a really big deal, not just for storage folks like me, but for everybody. The move to SMB 3.0, if you choose to make it, is probably the biggest change that's going to happen to your storage subsystem under your virtualization layer since iSCSI. And in fact, you could argue that the iSCSI move was minor in comparison. Because if you think about it, what really happened with iSCSI was we just took the same block protocols we were running on fiber and put it on Ethernet. Now, I know that's a little controversial in storage circles, but to a regular human being, that's basically the same thing, right? SMB is not that, right? And SMB is all about moving from blocks to files. And that's a pretty fundamental change. At NetApp, this is a change we've gone through before. In the VMware world, I know we don't speak VMware at this conference, but in the VMware world, this change has already happened, right? We've done NFS on VMware for quite a while. And the reason why I bring it up is because we have some experience about what happens when you move from blocks to files. So there's an interesting change that occurs. It changes the way you look at things. It flattens everything out. It changes the way you administer things, right? It pushes administrator responsibility up into the virtualization tier, away from the storage tier. All those changes are not guaranteed, but they're sort of implied, and we are making some assumptions based on our experience with NFS. So it will definitely be interesting to see how this plays out. Moving mission-critical workloads from SAN to NAS is the concept that we're looking at here. Because really, if you think about what's sitting inside of these Hyper-V VMs, this is really probably the crown jewels of your organization that are going to be living inside these VMs. It's very unlike the days when you're running Windows file services against the NetApp filer. I mean, because honestly, if you didn't have access to your Word documents for 10 minutes, you'd probably get a help desk call, but that's not that big of a deal, right? As long as you got it back, everybody was happy. On the other hand, if a Hyper-V VM loses its connectivity to the storage, the guest will blue screen. So it's really not okay for that connection to drop, even for a minute or two. So there's a totally different level of requirements that are coming out of Hyper-V sitting on NAS than a traditional NAS workload. From our perspective, we really look at this as a scaling issue. There is a certain scale where things like CSV just cease to make sense, right? If you have 10 VMs or 100 VMs, then CSVs probably work really well for you, right? You put 100 VMs on one CSV, you've got 8, 9, 10, 15 servers in a cluster. It's relatively easy to manage. On the other hand, if you have 1,000 VMs or 10,000 VMs, or you know, say you're a hoster and you have a very large Hyper-V environment, how are you going to manage every single one of those objects and make sure that they're all aligned correctly, that you've got them provisioned right, that they're assigned to the right tenant, right? It becomes very difficult to manage all those objects and ensure they're in the right place. On the other hand, when you move to a NAS-based protocol, you're basically looking at, if you want to do it this way, a flat namespace. And theoretically, you could have every VM in your entire environment sitting in one directory structure. Now, we all know in practice you probably won't actually do that, but the system, the technology, allows you to do that. So there's a very interesting scale thing that happens. Not to mention management simplicity, right? To be honest with you, I am a Windows guy, right? I'm not really a storage guy. I come from Microsoft. So I was at Microsoft for 12 years. So when you present me with a fiber channel environment, you say, okay, go ahead and present a fiber channel LAN. In the back of my head, I know how to do it, but in the back of my head, I'm still thinking, man, this is really kind of complicated. On the other hand, if you present me with a file share and say, here, put an ACL on that and drop a VHDX in this directory, it just makes more sense to me as a Windows person. The big thing, though, is we have to do this in a way that's very fault tolerant, right? As we mentioned before, dropping VMs and having VMs just die occasionally is not going to work for anybody. So none of this is going to work unless we're certain that we have a highly fault-tolerant system. So this brings up the old NAS versus SAN debate. It's really funny because actually in the history of my company, of NetApp, this debate's been raging for a long time. We originally were a NAS company. We started off as doing NFS appliances only. And then we came along later to the SAN game. And now the reality is for us, it doesn't really make that much difference, right? It's just a protocol, protocol fiber channel, protocol SMB. For us, it's just you turn a license on in the box and everything's fine. So this debate within NetApp has kind of gone away. But when you talk to the broader community and you participate in the blogosphere and you get on Twitter and stuff, this is actually a raging debate, right? People get really passionate about this. And really what it comes down to is that there's an argument out there, and I'm not going to make you raise your hands to see who's on which side. I'll just assume that this side of the room is the SAN side, and that side of the room is the... Uh-oh, he just got up and moved across. No, sir, I'm just joking. It's okay. You can stay. It's like a wedding, right? The bride's side and the... Yeah. So it really comes down to things like performance, fault tolerance, snapshots, right? And ultimately, in the Hyper-V space where I live, support, right? Microsoft doesn't support SAN at all, NAS at all. So we'll start with the bottom first, right? So obviously in Server 2012, that goes away, right? Hyper-V is fully supported on SMB 3.0, Server 2012, if you choose to do so. SAN is still there, right? So I have people come to me and say, wait a minute, I don't want to do Server 2012 on NAS. Okay, great, don't. But if you do, the question is it going to be performant? The answer that we have so far, now granted, we're still working with pre-release builds of Windows, right? And this is still in a lab, and we haven't actually put this in production yet, so all caveats apply. The performance we're seeing against things like ODX running on top of SMB 3.0 are very, very, very good, right? And in fact, in some situations, we can actually beat legacy fiber channel environments, which is an interesting statement, right? You're starting to get into the holy grail, religious wars territory. We make statements like that. So then it comes to fault tolerance, right? Is it fault tolerant? Can I walk up to my SAN and just unplug the head, and will SMB keep running? Will my VMs keep running? Because ultimately, that's what it comes down to, right? You should be able to take any box in the rack, walk to the back, pull the power cord out the back, and everything keeps working. It turns out that with continuous availability shares, it does, right? So in our case, there's kind of some magic we do underneath. That's the technical term we use, is the magic underneath. And we are doing things like managing persistent file locks and reservations inside the box, and we're replicating those locks amongst the physical heads and stuff like that. But you know, as a consumer, the Windows administrator is not really aware that that's happening. So we have to do a lot of work inside of our box to make sure this happens. But the important thing, I think, from a Microsoft perspective, is that the protocol, the SMB protocol, now, for the first time, allows us to do that. There just wasn't mechanically a way to do it before. And then finally, snapshots. So in the past, we were taking VSS-based, so application-consistent snapshots against LUNs, right, using Windows, using the VSS service. This is something we've been doing like forever. All of our competition does this. Pretty much any SAN vendor you're in bed with will do this. But you couldn't really do it against an SMB share. Well, first of all, there was no need, right, because you weren't running databases against SMB shares anyway. Well, that was until Denali came out anyway. But now you are. So you need a mechanism for doing that. So Microsoft has extended the VSS spec to allow you to run VSS against SMB shares. Now, mechanically, if you look inside of Windows, it's really the same thing. VSS hasn't really changed that much. All they did was they made VSS SMB aware. Now, on our side, in the SAN side, it is very different, right? Because the way that we take snapshots against a file is going to be a little bit different than the way we take snapshots against a LUN, right? One is a disk, the other is a file. Again, from the Windows administrator's perspective, I say, back this up, and when I ask for it back, I get it back, and that's what you really care about. From the SAN weenies perspective, or from the NAS weenies perspective, it's a bit different, and we've implemented it in a little bit different way, but the net result is exactly the same. And at least at NetApp, our intent is that the backup experience will look and smell and feel pretty much the same, right? And I'll give you a demo of this working a little bit later. So in the end, we feel like Windows 2012 addresses these top issues. So we think that we are now in a place where it's very reasonable to have a conversation about deploying enterprise class workloads on top of SMB 3.0 protocol. Now, is this to say that all of you are going to run out and immediately change from FCP to SMB 3.0? Probably not, right? But it does mean that now, for the first time, we can have that architectural discussion and we can make the choice for the right reasons, right? It don't work is usually not the reason why we chose to do it this way. That was what we got forced to do. The business requires X. That's the correct reason to do it. So this is an individual discussion. Everybody's going to be different, and that's great. But now it's an option that's on the table. The simplicity argument is the one that's most interesting to me. I spent a lot of time working with customers around operations. So my specialization actually is automation, right, and system center integration. That's where I spend most of my time. I actually own our private cloud product at NetApp. And so what happens is it turns out that when you're running at scale, right, thousands of VMs or tens of thousands of VMs, anything you can do to reduce the operational costs is a good thing. Right? If I can take a process that takes 6 steps today and I can do the same thing in 2 steps tomorrow, I'm interested. Right? Because even if I only save 5 minutes, if I save 5 minutes 1,000 times, now you're starting to talk about real money here. And it's all about running at scale when this matters. Right? If I have a small shop and I got 100 VMs total, maybe that doesn't matter to me. So let's think about what happens when I do a fiber channel LUN provision. Right? So I'm going to create my LUN, no big deal. As a Windows administrator, the next thing I have to do is I have to figure out what my worldwide name is. How many of you have your worldwide name memorized? Wow, that's kind of scary, sir. I'm not going to ask you about your personal business. All right. So it turns out that Windows administrators are not usually the fiber channel administrators. There's usually a different group, maybe even a different department that manages that. So now you have to go outside the departmental boundary, which, of course, is expensive, right? You just did a context switch on the processor. So now you do that. Then you get the fiber channel switch zoned. Now you got to go get your iGroup. You got to map your iGroup. Then you present the LUN. Then you wait for Windows to realize that that has happened. Then you format the LUN with NTFS, making sure, of course, that it's properly aligned, right? And you add it to the cluster. Then you wait, because the cluster has to recognize that's happened. And then you add it to a CSV. Now I have something that I can provision against. Not super hard, right? And in fact, I can write a PowerShell script to do this for you in about 10 minutes. But there are a number of steps here, and they may not be all under my control as a Windows administrator. Now let's look at what happens when we provision a share, right? So we go back to the SAN, we provision a share, we assign permissions, did I say provisions? Assign permissions, and then we map the share in Windows. And in fact, that step is optional. We're now done. You're completely done at this point. So now you've taken a multi-step process and you've really compressed it down, right, to basically two steps. So now you can see all of a sudden why people like us get so interested in this technology. It's like, well, hang on a second. So I can simplify my customers' lives quite a bit by simply changing the protocol. Okay, let's figure this out. How are we going to make this work? How are we going to make this scale? How are we going to make it stable? And so that's why we're spending so much time on this, is because we think that there's a lot of back-end value for people like you. So for us, for NetApp, what this means is that we have to support SMB 3.0, which is the new flavor of SMB that comes in Server 2012. And we will be doing so in what we call Data on Tap, which is our product, operating in cluster mode. When we look at inside what's really what we think are the key scenarios here, the key scenarios are Data on Tap running with what Microsoft refers to as continuous availability shares, which is what we just talked about, right? The highly available session state and all that kind of stuff, so you can lose ahead, everything goes good, everything's fine. ODX, which actually I'm going to do a quick demo of ODX in just a minute, and then VSS on SMB. So those are the three, we think, key scenarios. So this is a little bit of a large room, so I don't have a time to kind of poll you individually, but I would definitely love to get your feedback on this. We actually have a booth down in the expo hall. Please come by. This is something that we are actively working on, right? So we have it in the lab, you know, and of course in the lab everything works great. The trick is, the important thing is, how are you planning to administer it and what do you see are the key issues with it? Because that's what we want to make sure that we address as we go into production this fall. All right, so let's take a look at this. So what does this really look like? Enough of the yap. So what we have here is a Windows Server 2012 machine, and it's running a VM. Oh. And what's happening is that... lovely, I just dropped my VPN connection. Sorry. There we go. And so if you look inside, everything looks normal. Just regular old Hyper-V stuff, nothing too exciting. But the hard drive, that is not a disk, right? That's not blocks. That is a SMB 3.0 share, right? It's a UNC path, whack, whack, server name, share name. So that this dialog box, as boring and uninteresting as it looks to you, is about a year of my life just to make that dialog box work. And the reason is because when you attempt to mount a VHDX on SMB protocol, Windows Server 2012 actually interrogates the back end and makes sure that you're running the correct dialect, right? The right version and dialect and all that kind of stuff. And it actually interrogates to make sure that you state that you're capable of high availability operations. If you don't do that, it's not going to let you mount the share. So that's a very important distinction for us. So the reason why I bring this up, it's because if you go home today and you go to your trusty NetApp NAS box and you try to do what I just did, it won't work, right? We have to deliver to you SMB 3.0 to make this work. So please don't try this at home just yet. All right. So that's sort of interesting. But let's talk about performance. So one of the problems with SMB is performance. So let's say we want to do a copy operation, right? And you can see that's actually we're running really slow this morning. So, you know, you're going to be running over the network stack, right? So it depends on the host. It depends on what's going on with the network. It depends on the back end. There's a lot of core dependencies that are happening here that might slow this down. So that's SMB 2.0. Let's do the same thing now on SMB 3.0. So you notice it's exactly the same file. And I'm just going to make a copy of it. Right? A little bit faster. Right? We're going about 600 megs per second here. So this is still an interim build, still an early build. So, you know, we're still working on making this faster, but it's pretty quick. What's happening here is that Windows is actually not making the copy. And that's one of the reasons why there's a speed differential. What's happening is that now Windows Server 2012 is very aware of the fact that there's a SAN underneath. And that SAN may have advanced capabilities that Windows doesn't have. So what happens is Windows interrogates the underlying platform and basically is asking a very simple question. It says, are you ODX capable? And then it's up to us to answer yes or no. And then it says, here's the file, the to and the from. Are both of these source and destinations, are they also ODX capable? Again, the answer is yes or no. And if we say yes, then Windows says, okay, great. Go ahead and make this copy for me on my behalf, right? Hence the O in offline, right? Offline data exchange is what ODX stands for. And in our case, what we do is we then execute the copy offline inside the controller head. Now, what you just saw there was a file being copied within a single volume, right? Which is pretty much the best case scenario if you think about it, because the bits really aren't going anywhere. But it also would work across controller heads or in different scenarios. You also saw me doing this against an SMB backend share, right? But that's also not necessarily required as well. The other thing to note is just take a look at the performance of the NICs, right? So this spike right here was when we were copying over SMB 2.0, right? So what happens when you do an SMB 2.0 copy is it actually hits the CPU and the network cards of the client, right? And if you think about it, if you're running a very large environment, you could have quite a bit of load on the clients. Well, if the source is a storage device and the destination is that same storage device, why would we put load on the client? This doesn't really make any sense, logically. It just happens to work that way, but that doesn't really make any sense. On the other hand, if I just run it again really quick, right? There really isn't that much load being placed on the controller, right? So it's actually, it's hard to see here, but it's actually running 133K, right? So the copy is running at 600 megs, and the NIC is running at 133K. So it's kind of an order of magnitude difference there. Now, you will see a little bit of load being put on the NIC, and the reason is because there's some status messaging going back and forth, right? So when we initiate an ODX transfer, we give the client, in this case the Windows machine, a token, right? And then the client can come back and say, hey, by the way, here's my token, how are we doing? And that's the only reason why that status bar works, because otherwise he would have no idea what's going on. So you will see some chatter back and forth, saying, hey, how are we doing, how are we doing, how are we doing, how are we doing? But as you can see, it's minimal compared to the size of the operation. And in fact, the amount of chatter you get is consistent no matter how big the file is, right? You just get a very small back channel. Okay, so that's ODX, and that's something that we're working on for a future release. Now, naturally, ODX is a Windows protocol. It doesn't really have that much to do with NetApp. And in fact, I think our esteemed colleagues, the three-letter guys, I always forget their names. What is it? EMC, right, guys? Right, okay. There's some EMC guys in the front here. I think they showed this a very similar demo yesterday. So it looks like the industry is coalescing around ODX, right? And it looks like ODX is going to be a hit. We all seem to agree that ODX is a good thing. On our side, we are committed to support it. I think I mentioned this before, but just to repeat, ODX is actually not really protocol specific either, right? So keep in mind that I just showed you ODX running on SMB. There's actually nothing in the ODX spec that says it has to run on SMB. Right, so Windows will attempt to do ODX transfers regardless of protocol. So that could have been an iSCSI or fiber channel as well. Windows would have done exactly the same thing. So from our experience, the important thing for us is that this is a very seamless experience. I don't know if you were paying a lot of attention, because I know it's early, but I didn't actually run a special command, and I didn't use a special UI, and there actually was no NetApp software installed on the host. Right, so we can do copy offload right now on Windows Server 2008 R2, but to do it, you have to install a NetApp specific tool, right, that knows how to talk to the back end and can interrogate the back end and tells the back end to do things, which is fine. It works great, and it's a lot better than traditional copy, but it's not as easy as what I just did, which is basically right-click copy, right-click paste, and go. And the reason why this is really important to us is because it means every time Windows tries to do any copies, this always happens, right? So this would include things like SCVMM. If you think about what SCVMM does today, when you do a provision, it actually attempts to copy the template VHD. And it's a very expensive operation. In Server 2012, that won't happen. The first thing it'll try to do is do an ODX copy, and if possible, let the SAN or the NAS platform do that for you. So a lot of good things happen when you're smarter about the fact that you're sitting on top of advanced storage. So that's ODX. Very interesting. The next thing is VSS. So again, VSS has been around for a long, long time. There's nothing super new about the fact that we're doing application consistent backups and quiescing and all those kinds of fun things. But what's new is that we can now do it against an SMB share. So as you can imagine, once we move enterprise class data loads over onto NAS side, you're going to want to have exactly the same backup and restore capabilities, or hopefully better, than you have on blocks. It's going to be super important. So basically, it allows you to create application consistent backups against SMB shares in a very similar experience. Notice I didn't say very similar implementation, a very similar experience to what you're getting today on blocks. The only thing I'll note about VSS is that we are getting customers who are coming to us and say, you know what, I'm running a really large cloud, and I don't really know what's inside the VMs in my cloud. So what seems to be happening now is that backup and restore operations are becoming more and more generic, right? So in the past, NetApp and all of our competitors spent a lot of time making our backup and restore operations more and more application aware, right? So from us, for example, you've got a Snap Manager that does Exchange, right? And then you have one that does SQL, and you have one that does SharePoint, and I'm sure the EMC guys have exactly the same experience. All of us spent a lot of time making the backup and restore procedure more and more and more and more application aware. The problem with that strategy is that it doesn't really work well in the private cloud environment. In the private cloud environment, the operations team and the application owners have basically agreed to split, haven't they? Right? So you've got this platform that you're running, this very generic platform that you're running, and then there's apps running on it. What's actually in the VM? I don't know, right? I don't know, don't care. That's the definition of a cloud. So what seems to be happening is that the ability to backup and restore is actually moving out of the application and into the hypervisor. And most of my customers are saying, what I really want to do is I want to have one mechanism for backing up and restoring VMs, regardless of what's in them. So again, this is one of those conversations I'd love to have with you after the session, or come by the booth. That pivot, right, from application silos to clouds seems to be changing the way we all do backup and restore. And the reason why I bring this up is because now it's really about Hyper-V DR and Hyper-V backup instead of about Exchange or SharePoint or SQL. So it's a very different discussion than we would have had even a year ago, 2 years ago. All right. So let's take a look. So in this case, I'm going to cheat a little bit, and I'm going to do a video. And the reason why I'm going to do a video is because this whole operation takes about 10 minutes, and we don't have 10 minutes. So I'm going to compress this down a little bit. So my apologies for showing you a video instead of a live demo, but hopefully you'll agree with me that it's worth it. So what we have is our Hyper-V implementation. Again, surprise, surprise. Sitting on an SMB share, so a UNC path. In this case, it's just an IP address. So this is the same environment that we were on just a minute ago. And what you're going to see is you're going to have a set of data sets. And the concept of a data set is that you can take a collection of objects and then apply a retention backup policy to them, right? So if you think about it, really what this is it's all about SLA management. So what is the SLA that you've agreed to with your business owner, right? So this app is going to be backed up every day, every hour, every 15 minutes, right? So really what you should be thinking about if you're running large Hyper-V environments is, how do I provide service to my internal customer? And what type of service am I providing? And then how do I ensure that the service that I agreed to provide, I am actually providing? So example, you know, these VMs are gold-level VMs, therefore they're backed up every day, and those backups are copied off-site within 2 hours. So if I want them back, I can get them back within X minutes. Right? That's an example of a very simple SLA. So by putting these into groups, we basically are applying this policy, this agreement we have in the business, in software. So now the backup is happening, and what we're going to do is we're going to log into the controller back in. So normally you wouldn't do this, but we just wanted to show you the fact that, yep, sure enough, right, we're taking the snap, right? And the UI experience, which is kind of, we're showing you two things at once here. The UI experience, if you've ever used our backup product, should look very similar, right? Because it is, in fact, exactly the same product. The back end is different, right? The way it works is different. But it looks the same, it smells the same. So that we want administrators to not really care where their VMs are located. Whether they're on blocks or SAN, it should be exactly the same thing. Now we have done the backup. So let's say we want to get that back. So it's exactly very similar to what we do today. You click on that. You say, here is a protection group. Here's the backup sets within that protection group. Right-click on it. Boom, I want to get it back. The difference here is that because we're on a file share and not on blocks, our backup and restore granularity, it turns out, is actually file granular, right? Not LUN granular. And that's a very different experience operationally. So now you're thinking about LUN granular. So now the restore is happening, and basically what's happening is we're communicating with VSS, and VSS is communicating with Hyper-V. And what happens when you do that with Hyper-V? Hyper-V basically kills the current VM, right? Deletes it, in fact, and then creates a new one. He's laughing because he's like, I don't think that's a good idea, Alex. Why do you think it's on a video, dude? Okay, so, no, I'm just kidding. So when I showed one of my compatriots this video, and the first thing he said is, why are you destroying the production SQL server? Why don't you do that on the backup? So what's happening is VSS is actually taking this action for us, and it's the one that's actually negotiating with Hyper-V. So this is all happening within the context of a VSS session. So there's certain things that implies. So you couldn't really see it in the demo, but under the covers, VSS and Hyper-V are actually working together to do things like quiescing the guest operating system. And in fact, if you have a VSS aware application in the guest, that application is also quiesced. Now, this is not new. This is the way Hyper-V has always worked. But I know that VSS can be a little dark and mysterious to people if you don't spend a lot of time with it. And it's actually not very well documented, actually, even on TechNet. But what happens is that VSS is aware of the fact that you're running in a guest. And it does tell the guest operating system, hey, we're going to take a backup now, so please quiesce. And so that transaction is actually translated all the way down into the guest OS. Right, and then that backup is taken. So that process that occurs today on server 2008 R2 is almost exactly the same as on Windows Server. There's some enhancements. It's, you know, they've definitely improved performance and things like that. But the process, you know, if you wrap your head around the process, it's still the same and still familiar. Right. All right. So that's VSS for SMB. So as you can see, we're trying to build up a very similar enterprise class experience that you would get normally. So we're going to kind of shift gears a little bit and start talking about SQL Server. I'm going to hand over the clicker to John.
All right.
Sir?
So as we start looking at this and we look at SQL Server availability groups with 2012, that buys us a lot of different things that we can do in building a scale environment. So the features of 2012, you know, enhanced database mirroring. You have readable replicas. You have four sites, one primary, a secondary, a tertiary, and a fourth site that are all available to you in order to do different things. So you can have a read-only operations. You can have data mining operations, backup. Can go across any of the different nodes, and you're not impacting the primary environment. The challenges that we come into with the availability group is it's treated as a single unit. It's not treated as four individual units. So trying to back that up and ensuring where that backup takes place, you know, that's a challenge. And, you know, I think at NetApp we've actually come to that challenge. And now we have a tool that our beta begins in next week on the 18th, where we're backing up availability groups and making it so you can restore your availability group anywhere in that node so you can continue to make or keep that application available. So this is what it looks like. And then the other thing is we've also put in tools to make it easier to manage and deploy. And the demo that we're going to show is we're going to show about how to accelerate deploying that. And we use a couple of different things with that. We use tools for that NetApp provides as FlexClone and SnapMirror. So we're actually taking, if you look at this, we have two sites. Site A, or Site 1 and Site 2. In SQL 1, we have our primary database. And when we go about creating our secondary database, we'll do a flex clone. So what this does for me from a DBA perspective is now I'm going to create this clone, provide it to the second SQL server, and now I have an HA environment. So I have HA, and then I'll use SnapMirror to create and move the data to the second site. You have to pay the penalty of moving the data. So from a storage replication, we'll use StatMirror to actually take and pay that penalty of moving the data to the other side. And then we'll restore the database on the second site and bring it back into the availability group. And then we let SQL Server availability group replication keep all three sites in sync. And so now we have DR. So we have our high availability for our primary site, and then we have our disaster recovery for our secondary site. And we'll just jump in, and we have another video.
Number two.
This demo, what we're seeing here is we're creating the Windows failover cluster. So we're going through creating the Windows failover cluster. That's our enablement capability to actually create the availability groups. And then we'll start bringing all the nodes into that Windows failover cluster. Now we're going to go through and enable always on. And we found that PowerShell is a great tool for any kind of the management that we're going to do, because it allows us to do not just one time, but many, many times. And so now we're showing in here, we look in the properties and we see, hey, this is now a part of an availability group. We know which servers we have. And this is, we're showing our Snap Manager for SQL product, which helps us enable the backup and recovery of our availability groups. And it also allows us to make clones of our availability groups as well. So we can clone our databases very quickly, and we can clone all the databases in that availability group. And if you want to see this live, just come by our booth down there on the expo hall, and I'll do this for you live. So here we're showing that we've taken the backup. We went through our configuration, brought it into Snap Manager for SQL, and now we'll go and take the backup of the database. And we'll use this backup right here to copy and move it between the three different SQL Server instances. And the backup is really fast because we're using a snapshot to actually make the backup and then transport those. So now we look in here, we have the different SQL instances, and we can see that we don't have them. We have not moved VentureWorks, our favorite database, over to the other side. So now we're going to go through our PowerShell script And we're actually going to create this SQL or the AdventureWorks database on all the different sites. So now you can see we have the availability group. We have all three nodes in the availability group. And now we have to just get the data over there. So here we go through, and you can see in the script where we're creating the taking the snapshot and moving it and connecting it to the different different SQL Server. And so now it took about 3 minutes for us to move this, and now we have an availability group that spans two sites. And so I have my HA and I have my disaster recovery. And then we're going to show failover between the two here. So we go, we connect, and then we just do our failover. So now, if you look at the status and we refresh, what was once our primary site now is our secondary site. So you still have that really quick dynamic movement back and forth in your SQL environment. So just kind of wrapping up availability groups, we have Snap Manager for SQL, which enables and accelerates how we go about building our availability groups. We have backup and restore across all nodes of our availability group. And we're enabling NetApp SnapMirror and PowerShell to actually make this easier on the DBAs and the storage administrators. All right.
Thank you, sir.
Now I'll throw this back at Alex, and he can take you the rest of the way.
So the reason why we decided to have a little SQL discussion in there in the middle of a Hyper-V conversation is because as I mentioned before, what we're finding out is that all of these production workloads are now living inside the Hyper-V environment, right? So it's all about how do I provide core infrastructure that allows me to run whatever workloads that I want on top of a standardized platform. And what's interesting about that statement is it sounds pretty simple, right? It's like, oh, well, I'm just going to set up Hyper-V. I'm going to drop my workloads on there. And everything's going to be lovely. Yeah, but it's not really that easy, is it? Right? What happens when you want to do, say, capacity planning? So I want to know how many VMs my backend can support. So what's the first question that you need to ask to answer that question? I know it's early. What kind of questions are you going to ask about that? Any ideas? If I want to know how much capacity, how many VMs I can put on a single server, what do I need to know about those VMs? IOs, right? And how am I going to find out how many IOs they produce? Workload, right? What are those VMs doing? Well, but we already discussed the fact that if you're running a private cloud, you don't know what that workload is by definition. So it creates this very interesting dynamic where you have this requirement to provide very highly scaled, very highly available, very performant environments without being told in advance what exactly those environments are going to be doing. This is a kind of a problem. It's a paradox. We believe, again, I would love to hear your feelings on this, but we believe that the only way you can do this is through monitoring and capacity management. Notice I didn't say capacity planning, right? Since the variables that go into a capacity planning exercise are pretty much unknown, it makes it extremely difficult to do a real capacity planning exercise. That doesn't make it difficult to do a capacity management exercise, because capacity management exercises are based on variables that you do know, right? How many IOPS are my VMs actually consuming today? How many did they actually consume yesterday? And what is my trend line? Those kinds of questions you do know and you can answer. And it turns out that when you're running at scale, i.e. hundreds or thousands of VMs, it is valid to draw averages and conclusions from those averages. So if you have two VMs, one of them is running at 10 IOPS, and the other one's running at 100 IOPS, is it safe to assume that the next one's going to be 55 IOPS? Is it safe to assume the next one's going to be running, a little math here for you boys and girls, is it safe to assume the next one's going to be running at 55 IOPS? No, very good class, thank you. No, it's not, right? The law of averages doesn't work that way. Is it safe to assume that after I have 1,000 VMs and my average IOPS consumption is 55, when I have 1,001 VMs, is it safe to assume that my average consumption is still going to remain about 55? Yes, absolutely. You just passed Math 101. Yes, it is safe to assume that after 1,001 VMs that your average will probably remain about the same as it was at 1,000. This is one of those laws of large numbers problems. So capacity planning becomes more difficult, but capacity management actually becomes easier as you scale. And the reason why I bring this up is because we believe, that the most common thing that's going to happen is that large enterprises are inevitably going to move towards cloud-style architectures. Notice I didn't say cloud, and I didn't say public cloud, and I didn't say private cloud. I just said cloud-style architectures. And I'm intentionally being really vague about what that means, because honestly, I don't think any of us really knows what exactly that means. Right? We have some projections about what that means. We have some guesses. In fact, we have some really cool demos about what that means. But in practice, this is going to evolve for all of us, and we have to be flexible as we go forward. That brings me to the case study. So I was asked to present a case study about a customer called ING Direct. How many of you guys know who ING Direct is? Fantastic, right? Actually, I'm an ING customer. Any employees of ING in the room? No. Okay, good. I can talk about that. Fantastic. This isn't being recorded, is it? No. Okay. So I'm actually an ING customer. Love ING. They're a bank. Here in the United States, they're an online bank. Right? I mean, ING is actually a big bank in Holland, right? That's where they come from. But in the United States, they're an online bank. And they provide banks and services, and pretty much their life is software, right? Being an online bank, you're not doing anything unless you're doing it in software. So the ability to create software quickly is a huge issue for them. And in fact, they look a lot more like a .com or a software company than a traditional bank in the way they operate. When they produce a product, that product is software by definition. So it's really important that they are able to reproduce their environment for testing and dev purposes quickly. In the past, what they used to do is they had two test banks. And it was a whole set of servers, and they ran in a data center, and there was two of them. And if you were a developer, what you did is you went in there and you checked one of them out. And you ran your code, made sure it worked, and then checked out, and then repeat, right? Well, as you can imagine, ING is not a small company. They don't have two developers. They've got like hundreds of developers. This process gets a little unwieldy. Well, it's a little expensive to buy, 10 servers for every developer in the company. That's not going to happen. So what they really wanted to do is they wanted to have a mechanism where they could basically take the bank, the whole bank, and put it in a box, and then provision it to every developer. So basically, every developer would get their own bank. So that's a pretty hard thing to do, if you think about it, right? There's a lot of different systems and processes and things like that. But it was necessary for their business. And the reason why I bring this example up is because my message to you guys is, as IT professionals, and I'm assuming that because you're here at 8:30 in the morning in lovely Florida, you're probably an IT professional, that we tend to focus, and I'm including myself here, we tend to focus on features, on technology, right? We're engineers. We like flashy lights. But in the end, that's not really our function, right? Our function is to service the business that we live within. And, we all know that intellectually, but we don't necessarily always act that way, right? So when you look at what happened here at ING Bank, what happened was that the business had a huge problem. And they're like, look, we need to bring banking products to market faster. And IT, we love you guys, but this isn't working for us. We need something different. And so a couple of folks got in a room and said, you know what, let's just think outside the box and do something really radical. And what they decided to do was to develop their bank-in-the-box platform on top of a standardized unit infrastructure. Now, in our case, we call this FlexPod. And it's basically, it's the ability to take a standardized rack of gear, right, and drop it down into the data center, and then drop a private cloud infrastructure on top of that. So the concept here is to take standardized components and use them to deploy custom solutions on top. And this is where I get to the engineer versus business kind of conversation. As an engineer, my immediate instinct is to always custom design everything. Right? That's my business. I'm an infrastructure guy. When I was at Microsoft, I was an Exchange guy. You know, I've been living in data centers my whole career, basically. And so when you come to me and say, hey, I want to do this, the first thing I do is I say, great, where's the whiteboard? Right? Circles, arrows, figure this out. I'm going to build something that's absolutely perfect just for your specific requirements because I'm an engineer and that's what I want to do. It turns out the business may not want me to do that. Right? It may be what the business wants me to do is to do something that's quick, safe, right, i.e. tested by somebody else, and consistent. And that's what these pod-style architectures that are coming out allow us to do. Now, obviously, we're not the only people in the world doing pod-style infrastructures, and in fact, we didn't invent pod-style infrastructures, but that's what's happening, right? So what we see in the market is that people are starting to move towards these standardized infrastructures, not because they're better, necessarily, because they probably don't meet your exact exacting standards, but because they're more efficient, right? They're standardized. They work the same way. They're guaranteed by an outside agency. So your technical risk is reduced. It doesn't address your business risk or your process risk, but it reduces technical risk because you're simply repeating a solution that's been delivered by somebody else. In the case of Microsoft and the Microsoft ecosystem, there actually is a certification body out there that will say, yes, this platform is certified to run Microsoft private cloud, and that's called FastTrack. Right? So I don't know how many of you have been to the FastTrack session this week, you know, Mike Truitt and those guys, but basically what Microsoft has done, it says, look, here is what we, Microsoft, need, in a private cloud. So you have to have System Center, right? You have to have SCOM, you have to have Orchestrator, you have to have all these components to make a private cloud work. And here are the specific use cases that we want you to address. And you, as a third party, NetApp, EMC, HP, whoever, what we do is we submit a design to them. They have to approve the design. We actually go into a lab and an MCS, a Microsoft Services person, bangs on it for a while. It says, okay, let's actually test this out. Let's test these things out. The reason why I bring this up is because it goes directly against the discussion of buy versus build that all of us, I'm sure, have had in our careers many times, right? And that business trade-off between simplicity and efficiency versus customization. So this, you know, again, there's no right answer here. There's just options. So this is one option that you have when you start moving into these private cloud environments to say, you know what? In the end, the cloud is what matters. The services who run the cloud is what matters. Standardized infrastructure allows me to get there faster. So I'm going to give up a little bit of control, a little bit of design time control, to gain speed, efficiency, and reduce technical risk. So that's the theory behind these things. So in their case, in ING's case, they had a great result, right? So it used to take months to get one of these banks set up. Now it takes minutes, right? We're doing some stuff. We have some software that allows them to do things like clone an entire, you know, set of LUNs, right, in seconds, things like that. They have a self-service portal that's tightly integrated with their business process. In this case, it's a developer-oriented portal, right? Because remember, the customers here are the bank developers. So they can basically self-service to themselves. And again, when you going back to cloud, the notion of cloud, the theory here is always that it's based on automation and self-service. If we're not doing self-service and we're not doing automation, we really want to question whether or not we're actually building a cloud or we're just doing virtualization. Not that there's anything wrong with virtualization, but it's not cloud. Cloud is not virtualization, and virtualization is not cloud. Those are not the same things. And you know, they had a really good result. So we have a lovely quote here from the CIO of ING Direct. And you know, that we're very, very, very happy with the system that they've installed. And you know, for us, the lesson learned here is that pre-baked building blocks do enable customers who have really severe business needs to address them more quickly. And in their case, they were willing to give up a little bit of design time freedom to get that speed of execution. And there's a lot of money at stake, if you think about it, for these organizations that need to execute quickly. So just something to think about as you go forward and as you think about deploying your private clouds. On the Microsoft side, what this looked like was a System Center stack, right? So System Center is really great because it allows us to manage private cloud environments in tools that we're probably using already. So what I find is that most of my Microsoft customers already have things like SCOM, and they're probably already using VMM to manage their Hyper-V environments. So as we transition from virtualization to cloud, really what you're talking about is changing your management paradigm, automating your processes, adding orchestration, and then enabling that entire suite of things with a portal or a set of portals. So from a Microsoft perspective, you start at the top, you've got service manager system, Do you have a new tongue over there?
Yeah, no, there you go.
Okay, here we go. Thank you. System Center Service Manager. Hey, that worked. Which is the Microsoft component that does things like change management and ticketing and all that kind of stuff. In this model, it's actually the service manager that owns the end user interaction. And we really like this model because if you think about it, in a data center, you really don't want to do anything unless you have some sort of change management control on that action, right? If I install a switch or I change my IP configuration or I move a blade and that action does not show up in the change management system, there's probably something wrong. Because now what's going to happen is 6 months from now, I'm going to look for that object where it's supposed to be, and it's not there, right? Because I moved it. But I didn't go back to the change management system. So the idea of tickets being issued and tickets actually causing the action to occur is just a more natural flow for the way IT organizations actually work, right? I've never been in an IT organization in my life that wasn't ticket-driven, right? That's the reality. Users call, they make a request, we open a ticket, we take the action, we close the ticket. That's what we do. So in this case, what happens is you go into Service Manager, you open the ticket. That ticket, the fact that that ticket exists, causes Orchestrator to take an action. So let's say provision a VM, create a clone, mount storage. Those actions are automated through System Center Orchestrator. You also have tight integration underneath with Operations Manager. Remember we talked before about capacity planning versus capacity management, right? So capacity management is all about the capacity management tools that you have sitting on top of your infrastructure, making sure that all the different parts of your infrastructure are visible to that system. So in our case, in the case of Microsoft Private Cloud, what we mean is we mean Operations Manager and specific plugins for the various parts of your infrastructure. So in our case, what that means is a NetApp plugin that sits inside of OpsMan. OpsMan watches things like how many IOPS is the head generating, right? What's the CPU on the head looking like? How much space do we have on our aggregates? All that type of capacity planning information. It then shoves it into a data warehouse, which we can then interrogate. So over the last 6 months, what is our trend line for CPU utilization on head number one? Because that's really what you want to know. If the trend line, it looks like, it doesn't really matter if it's jaggy during the day. The question is, what's the trend line, right? Over the last 6 months, I went from an average of 10% to an average of 80%. That's kind of a problem, right? We might want to think about getting a new head. And then all that sits on top of PowerShell, right? So as you saw in the demos earlier, we're very focused on PowerShell and NetApp, as is Microsoft, of course. So everything that you can do on a NetApp controller, you can do in a PowerShell session. Right? So that's our commitment, is we're always going to expose all functionality in PowerShell first, and then we will also add UIs, that is to say, graphical interfaces, for things that are most commonly done. But everything always goes in PowerShell first. And hopefully this should sound familiar to you, because this is probably exactly the same lecture you got from Microsoft yesterday, right? Because this is their strategy. So what we're doing is we're simply following along with Microsoft's strategy here. And then, of course, all of this sits on top of Windows Server, right? And then in our case, it sits on top of a product called Data ONTAP. So just a quick, so that's what we're doing today. How many of you were in the SCVMM talk yesterday? Any of you? Nobody? Okay. So there was a presentation from the SCVMM team yesterday about something called SCVMM 2012 SP1, which is the next version of SCVMM. And the reason why I bring this up is because this is going to be the first opportunity that third parties like us have to add UI elements to SCVMM. So there's this notion of a plugin in SCVMM SP1 where we can add action. So what happens today is that if you want to do something like provision a LUN today, you have a couple of choices. You can use PowerShell, which is great, which is fine. You can use Orchestrator, which is good if you're a relatively large shop. Or you can use VMM, and inside of VMM, there's something called SMIS, right? SMIS is a really cool thing because it's an industry standard storage provider, right? And it allows VMM to talk to pretty much every SAN in the world. However, as you would imagine, because it's an industry standard tool, what that means is it does what we all do. It doesn't necessarily do what any one of us does really well. So it's nice, and it's definitely better than what we had before, which was nothing. But it's not really what we all want, right? What we all want is the ability to do very specific things on our platforms, right, and then light up the feature set of our platforms and make sure that you're getting the full value for what you bought, right? I mean, you paid a lot of money for that SAN. You want to make sure that you're actually using it. In SCVMM 2012 SP1, which is the product that comes out later this year, we will have the ability to do that for you for the first time, right? So I'm not going to make any announcements in this session about release vehicles or shipping dates and all that kind of stuff, but I just wanted to give you a little bit of a look ahead to say, yes, this is something we're all working on, right? So in the Windows Server 2012 timeframe, there will be a new version of System Center, right, obviously. Microsoft's working on it. We're working on it. I'm sure my colleagues over at EMC are working on it. And there will be the ability to build these kinds of very, very high fidelity provisioning, backup, management experiences right inside of VMM. So think of this like, if you've seen what we're doing with System Center and we've seen you're doing with SCOM, it's very similar in concept to what we've already done with SCOM and Orchestrator, right? So SCOM and Orchestrator have this kind of plug-in notion for a long time, but VMM was kind of notably absent and it didn't have that, right? So now we're getting that in VMM, which is a very exciting thing. All right. Woo! That's a lot of content. So I've been yammering on for a long time. So hopefully I've given you some visibility into things that are changing in the 2012 timeframe, into some of the workloads we're putting on it. Hopefully we've got some better understanding about how our data centers are going to evolve. I very intentionally didn't try to draw any conclusions from you, right? I don't think I have all the answers about the correct way to build your data centers, but we do understand what the options are, right? And so hopefully you can understand some of the trade-offs, some of the options as you go forward. I would strongly encourage you to discuss your Windows Server 2012 deployment plans with your service providers, with your hardware partners, right? Whether it's us or our competition, because the way you're doing things now may not be the way you want to do things in Server 2012. So we want to have a dialogue. If you're a customer of mine, I really want to talk to you about this now. And I'm sure that my friends at HP and EMC want the same thing. All right. Awesome. Thank you all very much for your time, and I'm happy to take questions now or after the session. Thank you all very, very much. Be sure to fill out your evals. And we'll take questions at the microphone if you want to ask questions. Right here, sir. I think we have about 10 minutes for questions, and then I'll have to skate. Sorry, you have to do the microphone because it's recorded.
With the ODX, two questions. With the ODX integration, with Server 2012, is that turned on out of the box? And if your storage backend, if your LUNs or your if your SMB shares have it turned on, will it automatically recognize it, or is there something you have to configure on the server side to get it to see it?
Yeah, so the question is around ODX and if ODX is automatic. The answer is yes. ODX, Windows Server 2012, ODX, in the current build of Windows Server 2012, ODX is on by default. I'm assuming that it will be in the RTM build, but we haven't actually seen it yet. What happens is it's actually a per-transaction setting. So when Windows Server, if you want to get really technical, what happens is somebody calls a Win32 file copy X API object. That object actually attempts to negotiate ODX right then, at the time the API is called. It attempts to negotiate. The backend answer is yes or no, and then the ODX transaction happens or doesn't happen. On our side, on the SAN vendor side, obviously it's going to vary, right? I can't commit to you whether it's going to be on by default or off by default in our product yet, because we haven't made that decision. But we believe on the Windows Server side, it will be on by decision, and that is the way it works. It is on by default in the current Windows Server builds,
okay,
is the
thanks.
Answer. Yeah.
The other question I had was regarding the, which was essentially the application-aware VSS backups you were demonstrating with, you know, inside, mm-hmm. you know, looking inside a C SQL inside
yep.
a VHD. If let's say, for instance, you needed to restore a single database or just get pull like an MDF, LDF
right.
type scenario out of that, is it possible to do a restore to a different location, like say into another VM, or is it an all or nothing transaction?
Yeah, so it depends on that's the reason why we still make tools like Snap Manager for SQL.
Right.
Right. So if you're backing up from the hypervisor down, the VM is kind of a black box, and you either get the whole VM back or you don't.
Yeah.
For sometimes, if you have one database, that's fine, right?
Yeah, but what happens when you have SMSQL, you have to have some mechanism to go in and pick out the individual databases. And that's where we have SMSQL to do that. He'll go in, he picks out the individual databases, and then you can go and get back a single database. So all the MDFs, NDFs, and LDFs that are required for that database, and then you can restore that to another SQL Server
right.
instance.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thank you. Sir?
In your lab right now, how does, I guess, what is kind of the payload or even the overhead when you compare something like a VMware accessing NFS doing that file access versus, you know, Hyper-V2, you know, SMB3.0 or VOBX?
Yeah, I mean, I can't really comment on performance numbers and expectations quite yet because we haven't published them, but let me answer your question in a slightly different way, if you don't mind. At a protocol level, the overhead is very similar. You know, we've gotten to the point now where SMB is a very efficient protocol, and we're really happy with it. You know, one thing that I'll say for Microsoft is that they've been really good on working collaboratively with the community, right? So I don't want to say this is like a NetApp thing, but they've been very good about saying, okay, where are our pain points on the protocol, and how do we move the protocol forward? So there's a lot of really good stuff in the protocol. We believe that we're going to get to a point where the protocol decision is based on administrative and business requirements, not on performance.
Right.
Right. That's a statement of belief right now, right? The intent is that once the product gets closer to shipping, you're going to see a lot more hardcore performance numbers from us, right? So the marketing and legal guys are like, you know, you can't say X, Y, and Z, so there's some things that we can't talk about yet. But at a protocol level and at an implementation level, our intent clearly is to remove performance as a reason why you'd pick protocol X, Y, or Z. Does that answer your question, sort of? Kinda.
Yeah.
And yeah, we can get into, if you come by the booth, we can get into a non-disclosure briefing. If you're a NetApp customer, we can give you information under non-disclosure that I can't discuss publicly,
yeah,
if you want.
Probably around the world of a VDI where you're having lots of little VMs.
Yeah, actually, right. Yeah, so I don't know if you could hear that, but about VDI specifically, there's lots and lots of instances, and yeah, absolutely. And in fact, if you come by the booth, we're showing a performance demonstration right now where we boot 500 VDI instances in 5 minutes or
yeah,
something like that?
Yeah, about 5-6 minutes.
So we actually have a performance, there's a performance guy in my booth right now who does nothing but VDI. So I think that's more of a one-on-one conversation.
Okay. Yeah. Thank
yeah. Thank you very
yeah,
much.
Yeah, come by and see us.
Yeah. One more? Yeah, one more.
So my question is with the ODX. So if your VMM is running on 2008 R2 today, but you're going to do an ODX copy from server B to server C that's 2012, would ODX still work? Or does everything have to be 2012?
Yeah. So my understanding from Microsoft, and should I answer this question? Yeah. So my understanding from Microsoft is that there will not be an ODX server 2008 R2 backport, right? It's a client protocol, right? So whoever initiates the copy must speak that language. And so right now, what that would mean is if either the source or destination were server 2008 or 2008 R2, then
no, they're not. They're both 2012, but the guy who tells the 2012 to talk to the other 2012 are both OD, obviously.
So if I understand your question.
So I want to use server A to tell server B to copy a file to server C. Server A is 2008 R2.
So if you did something like a PS remoting session, and you remoted into the server 2012, and correct, you told server 2012 to copy, then ODX would occur.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it'd be at that point, it'd be how does VMM work under the covers?
Yes. In the case of VMM, the VMM server itself must be on a Windows 2012 server, is the answer.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, thank you all very much. Thank you.
Thanks.